From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the aftershock of last week's shooting deaths at two Boston-area abortion clinics. We'll talk with people on both sides of the abortion issue. We'll hear from Dr. Susan Wickland, who has stepped up security at her Bozeman, Montana clinic. She's faced many threats against her life. In fact, one man who sent her about 60 threatening letters is now in prison. We'll ask two leaders of the anti-abortion movement if the movement should be held accountable for the murders. We'll hear from Flip Benham, National Director of Operation Rescue, and Reverend Pat Mahoney, Director of the Christian Defense Coalition. And journalist Verlin Klinkenberg will share some of his experiences reporting on the abortion clinic staff and the anti-abortion activists demonstrating outside of two Wisconsin clinics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Abortion may be legal, but many people who work at abortion clinics face persistent threats against their lives. In the past 22 months, five people have been shot and killed at abortion clinics by anti-abortion vigilantes. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear reflections from both sides of the abortion issue on the two murders last Friday at Boston area clinics. Dr. Susan Wickland owns and is the sole doctor at a women's health clinic in Bozeman, Montana. She's worked in several regions of the country where few, if any, doctors were willing to perform abortions. For several years, she commuted between clinics in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and North Dakota in communities that otherwise would have had little or no access to abortion. I asked her if she's been more alert to danger since last Friday's murders.
Oh, yes. Yes, all of us are so much more aware. We have been all along, but even more acutely now, of who walks in our front door, who's out in the parking lot at the clinic, is there a car following us home, what was that strange phone call we had at 10 o'clock at night. We think about it all the time. I fear for my staff all the time, and it makes me very sad that we have to live like this.
Last spring, President Clinton signed a bill that's known as the FACE Act. FACE is an acronym for Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances. Mm-hmm. And it makes it a crime to prevent people from entering a clinic, to prevent them by the use of force or by threat of force or by obstructing the clinic entrance. Has that been helpful to you?
Definitely. It's definitely been helpful, both psychologically and in a very real sense. Now we have a situation with FACE where if local authorities are not willing to prosecute, at least the federal government does have the right to come in and do it, and in most cases is doing that. I think FACE was a wonderful thing, and I'm hoping that it will continue to be enforced.
The last time we spoke, which was in the fall of 1993, I had asked you if you'd noticed any change in the demonstrations at the clinic where you worked, and you said that you thought that the people who weren't extremists had basically stopped showing up at demonstrations because they didn't want to be associated mm-hmm. with terrorists. Mm-hmm. Is that still happening in your observation?
Yes, it certainly is. From what I can see in here in Montana and around the clinics here, that many of the clinics have continued to experience a decline in the number of daily protesters out front, but an increase in the violence by a handful of people.
Anything else you're noticing that's changing?
I think one of the things that's most disturbing for me is the language that I hear on the radio and TV and see in the newspapers, where they're quoting and repeating what the anti-abortion leaders are saying. That language is coming across our, through the media over and over and over again, and it's very destructive language. And I think anyone who says that the types of things they do, that the stuff that demonizes abortion providers, have to take responsibility for the violence of the people who listen to those words. When I see an article about Paul Hill in the paper, and it talks about his, he thinks it was a very moral thing for him to do to kill an abortion doctor, and that's in print over and over and over again, and yet are we hearing anything or seeing anything about the victims, about the physician that he killed, or the escort that was with him? How about the two women that were killed in Massachusetts? I don't see their, you know, much in the media about their families and their lives and what's happened. They've become nobody, and the media or the anti-abortion people have made the murderers into heroes, and that language is repeated over and over again. It's very frightening to me that it's okay to say that. It's okay to say in the media over and over again that it's okay to kill abortion providers. It's real frightening.
I think there are people on both sides of the abortion debate who have expressed concern that new laws, like the law that prevents people from blocking access to clinic entrances, are having the paradoxical effect of leading to more violence because the old ways of protesting are becoming more difficult to do, so people are doing things more extreme.
I don't believe that at all. I feel like people still have the right to peaceful protest in an appropriate time, place, and manner outside of a clinic. If they stay within the law and are still exercising their First Amendment rights in an appropriate way, they can still express their views about abortion. They have been stopped, we're trying to stop them through FACE, etc., from doing the more violent things. But to say that because they're no longer allowed to do small violent things, that now they have to go to large violent things, is ridiculous to me.
I know there was a man who had repeatedly threatened you, mm-hmm. who is now in prison.
Yeah.
What were the threats?
Oh, well, he was a man that wrote me better than 60 letters. And actually, I had just written a letter to somebody about this man, and I have one of them in front of me, and I'll read a little bit of what he wrote.
Sure.
He started out the letter, "Dear Butcher of Bozeman, how would you like to be slowly suffocated and burned to death in saline? I think it's only fitting that you should feel all the pain that you wantonly, etc. Let's tear your arms and legs off one by one. Let's tear your legs off one by one. Only fitting, one only fitting. How would you like your skull crushed into fragments, tissue, and blood? You should suffer all the torments and agonies of the human beings you murder. Only fair, you cold-blooded, deprived, despicable person. We demand that you stop the killing now. Mike Ross." That's the kind of letters that I got over and over again. He wrote things like he relishes the struggle as things heat up, that he was going to shut me down, that he was going to tear the flesh off my body. Getting letters like that in the mail on a daily basis is pretty terrifying. He is in prison now. He did come up for parole not long ago, and there was a huge outpouring of support on my part to keep him in prison, and we were successful at getting his parole denied.
What would you like to see people in the anti-abortion movement who aren't extremists, who aren't terrorists, do to try to prevent further acts of terrorism?
I think one of the best things that people who are truly anti-abortion but not pro-violence can do is to speak out against the violence, but also to let us know who they think is violent. Surely they hear words. Surely they have some idea of who the craziest people are, of who they're afraid of, who they don't want to be seen with in front of the clinic. And in order to save the lives of the people in the clinic, the staff and the patients in the clinic, if they could speak out and let us know who, again, who the most violent people are, who they're afraid of, and when they hear things being planned, they need to let us know. There's people out there who are anti-abortion and who know who've set the fires. They haven't done it themselves, but they know who's been burning the fires down and who's been saying the death threats, and they may even know who may be planning to try to kill another doctor. And if they would tell us, they need to speak up. I think it's their responsibility to help end the violence.
Being constantly under the threat of attack and now having the thought of these murders from Friday on your mind, is it hard to actually do the medical work? Is it hard to actually, you know, focus on your patients?
Interestingly enough, the one place where I find peace and where I feel like I'm grounded and that everything comes together for me is when I am working with the patients. If we have a busy day and I'm with patients all day long, I do very, very well. It's the days when things are slower and I have more time to think about it and more time to worry about that front door opening that are much harder to concentrate and do things. But no, my peace is in that patient room, and it goes very well. The medical part of it has not suffered at all.
Dr. Wicklund, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Susan Wicklund spoke to us from her women's clinic in Bozeman, Montana. We'll hear from two anti-abortion leaders after a break. This is Fresh Air. Reverend Flip Benham is the national director of Operation Rescue, a group which describes itself as supporting and encouraging Christians who stand on behalf of unborn children. He condemns the shootings at abortion clinics and says they're the work of vigilantes who the larger movement cannot be held responsible for. I asked him what he does if someone suspicious comes to a meeting, someone he thinks may show up at a clinic with a gun.
I confronted Paul Hill in April of this year in Chicago, and I beseeched him in the name of Jesus, for the cause of Christ, for the sake of the children waiting to be born, and for the sake of his family, that he cease and desist spreading this public heresy. It is wrong, it is sin, it is called murder, and it is never right to do wrong to gain a right end. And I made that clear to him, and he told me that he thought he would never be one that would do such a thing. And yet, I know that wrong theology inevitably leads to wrong behavior. You know, you can't think about adultery very long before your body begins to follow it. And what happened was that Paul Hill pulled the trigger on July 29th, early in the morning, and killed two people there. That was sin. If I was there when Paul Hill had pulled out that weapon, I would have gotten in between. He would have had to have killed me first. This is the Christian response. This is what we are supposed to do.
Clearly, some people, some extremists, like the alleged murderer Friday, are hearing something different in the anti-abortion movement than you want them to be hearing.
Absolutely.
Right. They are hearing that it's appropriate to go out and shoot somebody. Right.
And that we have dealt with over and over again. We will not allow a Paul Hill. We will not allow a Michael Bray or an Andrew Burnett to speak at any of our events. These people that say that that homicide is justifiable in the case of an abortionist, that is a lie from the pit of hell. The church will not allow these people to speak. They are silenced. It is not all right to shout fire in a crowded theater. And this theology of theirs is devastating. That's why we've silenced them. They cannot speak at any of our events, and we make it very clear why they can't.
Is this a time for you to reflect on the language your group uses in opposing abortion and to ask yourself if that language is unintentionally inflaming vigilantes with guns?
Okay, I think I can answer that very simply. It is not our rhetoric. It is the inflammatory truth of what is happening to little boys and little girls. The answer is that little boys and little girls are being killed in these mills. There isn't anything I can do to change that truth. Now, the pro-choice side would like to say, well, that's going to cause people to shoot. Well, then you probably need to deal with the truth. This is what you're doing. The truth is the only weapon we have. It is the only weapon we will use. And by the way, it is very effective.
Last spring, President Clinton signed a bill that's known as the FACE Act. Right. FACE is an acronym for Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances. And this bill makes it a crime to block entrances or, you know, to prevent people from entering or to threaten them as they enter. How has this affected your group's strategy?
Well, it simply hasn't. We know that no matter for how long they put us in jail, you know, this is part of our heritage as Christians, following our Lord. You know, he went all the way to the cross and died for us, and those who follow him will find out, well, half of the New Testament was written from jail, and we need to remember that maybe jail isn't a bad place to be when you have a nation that is killing children. And, you know, the FACE bill was made to silence the Christian message, to get the Christians off the street. It has absolutely no effect on vigilantes. They're going to do whatever they want to do, whenever they want to do it. But it is an attempt to move the peaceful Christians off of the streets. What we have to do is keep the peaceful Christians on the street so that there will be peace in the streets and there will be more peace in those abortion mills where children die.
Your group, Operation Rescue, just put out a press release saying that the murders last week at the Boston area clinics are just a harbinger of what's to come.
Yes, and what
is to come?
Well, you haven't seen anything yet. What ended in 94, if we continue killing children in this nation, the murder that we see rampant in 94, and I'm not just talking about outside abortion mills, I'm talking about all over this nation, is simply and only going to increase, and there isn't a police force big enough. You know, we have more people per capita in jail in the United States of America than any other nation in this whole globe, and we still can't take care of the violence that is savaging us. We don't know what to do. I'm telling you that if we don't get on our knees before Almighty God, and that's why we're calling churches to gather together on January 21st at 6 o'clock until January 22nd at 6 o'clock and mourn and weep and pray and fast and repent over our own sin, if we don't have God that will bring healing to this land, then there is no hope for us at all, because it only gets worse. We are reaping the consequences of what we have sown, and that is murder in the streets that is savaging our children.
Reverend Flip Benham is the National Director of Operation Rescue. Reverend Pat Mahoney is a leader in the anti-abortion movement. He's former national spokesperson for Operation Rescue and now is executive director of the Christian Defense Coalition, which he says is primarily a political lobbying group. I asked him how he thought the anti-abortion movement should respond to the recent murders. He told me he thinks the anti-abortion movement should repudiate these acts and that these murders in no way reflect what the movement is about.
It just seems an incredible contradiction to me that a person could call themselves pro-life and then support the shooting of people at a clinic. So I think the first response is to utterly condemn and repudiate without exception what happened in Brookline and in Norfolk, and of course Pensacola earlier in the year. I think on another level, though, and here's where there's some differing of opinions, I think how to take steps to see that this violence doesn't increase or continue is where there is a bit of philosophical difference within the movement. For example, Cardinal Law, the Archbishop of Boston, who is a person whom I respect, I believe is making a grave error in calling for a moratorium on demonstrations in front of clinics. History has shown that when peaceful people of goodwill are in front of clinics demonstrating, I'm a Protestant minister, but praying the rosary, holding signs, and perhaps even engaging in flamboyant and provocative speech, yet nonviolent speech, that clinics are the safest.
Have you ever been in the position where someone who struck you as mentally unbalanced or someone who struck you as a potential terrorist, murderer, shown up at a meeting or a rally? And if so, if you had that suspicion about them, what did you do? Did you act on it, call authorities, or have a private talk with them?
Yes, the answer is yes. Yes, there have been people who have come out to our events or come out to meetings, and they say things like, this clinic would be better burned to the ground. And we have told them to leave, and we have rebuked them, and I have heard in some cases where pro-life leaders have told local law enforcement agencies that this person has been at a meeting saying this clinic would be better burned to the ground. You have to understand, from a moral perspective, we repudiate this. From a tactical perspective, this has done nothing but destroy the image and credibility of an entire movement. So there is to be nothing gained from here outside of the immorality of taking of human life. From a strategic or tactical point of our movement, it behooves us to get these people out and to weed these people out. I have to say that they represent a fraction of the number of people who peacefully go out in front of clinics every day.
I have to say, I think, you know, you're maybe underplaying the tactics of groups like Operation Rescue and just referring to how peaceful they are, because from the point of view of the medical staff at abortion clinics and from patients, it's really serious harassment when in the past they've blocked entrances or you know, verbally harassed people are going in, or you know, bolted themselves to doors or to cars or whatever.
Harassment is a subjective term. I mean, are we to say that saying abortion is murder. See, no one, and you're not, or Kate Michelman isn't, or Patricia Ireland isn't, or no one is, if saying abortion is murder and calling an abortionist a murderer, if that's disturbing to people inside, and I'm sure it must be, that's what free speech is all about. It's to be provocative, robust, and disturbing. That's what our founders intended. And what I'm hearing, the implication that I hear from that question or from pro-choice leaders, is they want to censor us. What, do they want us? Let me say this. There is no antiseptic way to describe abortion. It's the killing of an innocent human life. There is no antiseptic way to describe the Holocaust in Germany or racism or sexual harassment or starving children in Somalia. I mean, starving children in Somalia is not an eating disorder. The Bosnian conflict is not religious differences. And abortion, how would one want us to describe it? In taking this line of approach that it disturbs people in the clinic, it disturbs people. Free speech, provocative, robust speech, disturbs people.
You won't allow people who preach murder as a tactic to speak at your meetings.
Who advocate violence of any kind, spray painting clinics, putting tacks in parking lot, gluing locks, that kind of thing, making harassing phone calls, none of that. All that is immoral.
Where do you draw the line between what speech should be allowed and what speech shouldn't be allowed at your meetings and in the public arena?
Well, that's really not as difficult a question on this subject as it would seem. Anything that advocates or supports violence, obviously justifiable homicide, spray painting clinics, butyric acid, popping windows out, tacks in parking lots, gluing locks, harassing phone calls to, let me change the word harassing because that's so subjective, threatening phone calls. I think there's a difference between a legal definition between threats and harassment. Threatening phone calls, death threats, we're going to get you, your family's in trouble. These things are reprehensible. I think anything else falls under the tone of free speech. Abortion is murder. Baby killing, whatever, blood's on your hands. Certainly very colorful language, very provocative language, but I think very protected language. I think when someone says something that is a direct link to a violent act, that's what needs to be labeled as, if you will, yelling fire in a movie theater. I think when someone says abortion is murder or abortionists are murderers, I think that's certainly within the protected realm of free speech. And I am fearful. I cherish free speech. And I'm afraid that we're entering a realm here where people calling abortion murder will end up being a hate crime. I think that's just disgraceful. And I'm surprised that more liberal people who cherish free speech on this particular issue, I guess it's okay for child pornographers to walk free, but it's not okay for someone to say abortion is murder.
Reverend Pat Mahoney is Executive Director of the Christian Defense Coalition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More on violence at abortion clinics in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our examination of violence aimed at abortion clinics. We talk with Verlin Klinkenberg, who reports on two Wisconsin clinics and the demonstrators outside in the current edition of Harper's Magazine. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're devoting today's program to the subject of violence at healthcare centers that provide abortions. Verlin Klinkenberg is a reporter who wanted to see what the confrontation surrounding clinics looks like from both sides. He spent time at two Wisconsin clinics, inside with the staff and outside with the protesters. His article, Violent Certainties, is published in this month's Harper's Magazine. I asked him about the tactics of demonstrators in Milwaukee. He said some demonstrators use prayer and peaceful protest. Then he told me about more extreme tactics.
It goes from people throwing themselves under cars, which the locals there come to call speed bumping, and people jumping on tops of cars, which they call hood surfing. But also there have been cases where vans have been driven into the front and rear doors. And recently there's been a much more complicated kind of strategy called a lock and block, in which a person drives up in a specially modified car that has all sorts of contraptions welded to it, including there's a hole cut in the floor so the driver can slip down onto the ground, making it impossible to tow the car away without cutting the person in half. There were two of those lock and block staged in Milwaukee in the last 8 months, and it takes the firemen and police hours to remove these people, and it costs the city hundreds of thousands of dollars each time. And it is not actually effective in closing the clinic. It's just an enormous civic disturbance.
I think it's fair to say that you tried to give yourself the exercise of trying to understand the world through the eyes of the anti-abortion protesters and the people who worked in the clinic that you were reporting on. Mm-hmm. So you spent some time in the parking lot looking at the protesters and some time in the clinic talking with the medical workers there. What surprised you about trying to see the world through the eyes of people on both sides?
Well, there were a couple of surprises for me. One is I had, like most Americans, I think, a kind of unclear vision of who these protesters were. And I need to say really clearly here that I'm not really talking about ordinary, decent protesters, people who out of conscience come and pray or distribute information or offer alternatives to abortion. I'm talking about a very small, mostly fundamentalist, very radical and violent fringe, the people who stage these lock and blocks, the people who, when interviewed, advocate the shooting of doctors, that kind of group. So what I was surprised by on that side was, first of all, how scary this fringe element really is, because it really is a terrifying bunch of people. There's a kind of alien quality to them, I found, and I could think of no way, in a sense, to make contact with them, even though I tried. I think they viewed me as suspect automatically, and that's partly, of course, because they're always operating under kind of suspicion. What surprised me, really, from the other side, being in the clinics, talking to patients, talking to doctors, talking to medical personnel who assisted the doctors, was I think that when I came out to Milwaukee, I'd been laboring under the assumption that many Americans do, that an abortion clinic is a place that's necessarily kind of grim and just full of kind of wretched moral overtones, and a place that wasn't pleasant to be a place that you came and sort of did your business and got out as quickly as can as you could and put out of your mind. But what I found both at Paul Seymour's clinic in Wisconsin and especially at Liz Carlin's clinic in Madison was, first of all, an absolutely, it was like any doctor's office, cheerful, brisk, of course, but very humane, very welcoming, very warm. And at Liz Carlin's office particularly, I found really an extraordinary effort going on to talk to the women who came in and to convince them that what they were going through was an attribute of a lifestyle that could be changed, that it was merely a step towards taking a kind of greater responsibility for their lives, for their reproductive fate. It was actually, I think, for many of the people who came through that clinic, tremendously kind of inspiriting experience. My sense, talking to the advisors, talking to the patients, was that very rarely in their lives had these women been treated with such dignity and such acceptance.
My guest is Verlin Klinkenberg. His article about demonstrations at abortion clinics is published in this month's Harper's Magazine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about demonstrations at abortion clinics with journalist Verlin Klinkenberg. One of the things you did while you were writing the story was that you saw a fetus mm-hmm. after an abortion. What emotional impact did that have on you?
Well, it has a profound emotional impact. I saw two examples of fetal remains from very closely spaced, 8 and 10 week gestation, if I recall correctly, which is early and is typical of this vast majority of abortions in the United States. There is an unquestionable shock at seeing the remains of any operation, but in this case there was a particular shock because in the case of the fetal remains that were slightly older, there was a recognizable very, very tiny hand and foot. And I was overpowered at first by the recognition implicit in seeing that and recognizing that form. But what I realized as I was watching it was that one of the things that's happened in this debate is that it is always very easy to put a tremendous amount of emphasis on a fetus, on what the anti-abortion protesters call babies. What I saw was not a baby. It was barely even a recognizable form. But what bothered me was that it was so easy to project a kind of innocence upon it. And in doing so, you had to project a kind of guilt upon the woman who had come. And what I found myself thinking about was the fact that that first gesture of a kind of awestruck empathy and grief, really, at seeing this form was not the only response that was important. The other response that was more important, to me at least, was to think very carefully about the life of the woman who had come and who had made this decision. The fact that she had, it was hard to project innocence upon her because she already had a life that had a defined form. It was hard to make the kind of dogmatic assertions you would about the potential character of a fetus when a woman had already achieved a life, had already achieved a decision, had already made difficult choices in her own life. So for me, the move in my own, really, and this took place in seconds, the move was from a kind of profound empathy for, I hesitate to say a creature, but a thing on which I was sort of preconditioned to impose a kind of innocence, to, I think, a much more understanding and much more important and realistic empathy and understanding of the woman whose choice this had been.
Do you think a lot of people find it easier to identify with a fetus than with a woman?
I do, because I think they're able to project whatever they want upon a fetus. They're able to see it as a, to imagine it as a one-month-old baby, to imagine all of its potential, to imagine its almost religious innocence. But a woman who has made this choice, who has taken control of her reproductive fate, she has the kind of crusty identity that we all have. You can't go around imposing your sense of innocence upon her. I'm speaking a little abstractly here. She tends to reject it, and just the way any individual tends to reject it. And that's the dilemma here. I think that it's very easy for people to make all sorts of categorical assertions about what this is that remains at the end of an abortion procedure, what it might have been, what fate has been sidetracked here, without ever thinking about the woman herself. For me, what it came down to, what I began to realize as a result of this time spent out there, was this issue is about a very simple matter in some ways, and it is who controls the reproductive fate of women. I speak especially to men on this issue, because it's very important for men to ask themselves this question. Who has ever tried to control your reproductive fate? Who has ever put a block in your way? Who has ever forced you into some kind of sexual or reproductive decision? The answer is almost always no one, ever. But I think women deal with that reality daily.
A few people have said that those who oppose abortion but are reasonable in their opposition, as opposed to believing that murder is the solution, that these people aren't really showing up at the demonstrations anymore because they're so alienated by the extremists who seem to have taken over. Was that your observation?
Well, it was my observation. There was great to-do made of the fact that the anti-abortion movement in Milwaukee could muster thousands of people when it wanted. But in fact, at every clinic, there was a small group of protesters, very well known to the clinic defenders and to the clinic staff, who have really given their lives to this subject, and in many cases were funded in ways that were kind of mysterious by groups that had a name but no real identity. My sense is that this debate has become so polarized that, in effect, most Americans have dropped out of it, and I think that's making the situation worse. And I think the solution to somehow dealing with the character of this debate is for Americans to understand that, you know, this is not a debate that you can really afford to drop out of. It is not reasonable to expect to have rights that you are not willing to defend. And that's very much what we're facing here. The debate, the legislation, the character of this whole issue is being framed by extremists. It is not being framed by reasonable people. It's being framed by anti-abortion extremists. And there are a couple of paradoxes here that I think need to be brought in. I think it's perfectly possible to be anti-abortion and yet to acknowledge the right of abortion clinics to exist. I think the way to deal with this issue is to try to promote, if you want to end abortion by creating an atmosphere of greater sexual frankness in the United States. One of the people I talked to in Milwaukee was a gynecological surgeon who was raised in Holland, and his observation is that the rate of abortion in Holland is much lower than it is in the United States because the rate of pregnancy is much lower. In other words, they're doing a better job of dealing with the fundamental issue of how we get pregnant.
My guest is Verlin Klinkenberg. He reports on two abortion clinics and the demonstrations outside in this month's Harper's Magazine. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the new Congress?
Well, Newt Gingrich is before the House Ways and Means Committee, Terry, talking about the contract with America. Others are testifying on the Senate side at the Judiciary Committee on the possibility of passing a balanced budget amendment. And we'll also have a piece on the 104th pulls onto the information highway, if they put as much paper through the Internet as they do through the Congress. It may clog the thing up. We'll have a piece from Ann Garrels about Chechnya and also go to the auto show in Detroit.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Verlin Klinkenberg. He reports on two abortion clinics and the demonstrations outside in this month's Harper's Magazine. One of the things you wrote about in your article in Harper's was the sense of certainty, complete, unshakable certainty that the demonstrators had.
Mm-hmm.
What effect did seeing that absolute certainty have on you?
Well, the best way to describe it is to recount a conversation I had with one protester who used to really just scream, and now actually will talk. And I went up to him and told him what I was doing, which was writing about abortion in Milwaukee, and would like to talk to him about it, his views, what he believed, why he was there. And very quickly, even though the tone was rational, we got to a question. Do you think that Jesus Christ approves of abortion? And what I keep hearing from these people is their absolute assurance that they know what God believes, what Jesus believes. This absolute, unwavering assurance. There are many components to faith, many components to religious belief, many aspects of a pursuit of a spiritual life, but that kind of hardcore, dogmatic certainty did absolutely nothing for me. It ended the conversation because I found it so arrogant and presumptuous. And it belonged, really, that kind of certainty, that kind of insistence that they were entitled to speak for Jesus or for God, belonged to no religious experience that I'm familiar with. And I was raised a good Methodist. I mean, it just seems to me to fall outside of the range of normal religious discourse.
When you were covering the abortion clinics, did it feel like something completely outside of your experience to watch the demonstrators and watch the medical workers who had to be so careful about where they walked and mm-hmm. how well protected they were? Did it feel like you were suddenly in the middle of a war zone?
No, it's not. In fact, that's what was odd about it. The normality is deceptive. You know, one minute you're standing next to a Kmart or a gas station, the next minute you're standing in this mess of people in front of a really, just a medical building that has many other services in it, but also has an abortion clinic. And what I thought about when I was writing this article was, how can you get people to see that in the midst of this apparently normal, often very ugly landscape, there is this thing going on, this battle being waged that is being waged very quietly but with great intensity, and it seems to be just a part of the fabric of life we've created around us. It would have been, I think, easier to understand in some ways if it had felt more like a war zone, but it didn't.
Was there anything that happened in your life that led you to want to explore this issue?
Well, there were two cases in which women I had loved had become pregnant, and without respect to who they were, the decision was made to have an abortion. In one case, completely without any input on my part, and in the other case, with complete input on my part. And it was, in both cases, they were responsible decisions, and very right for the time and health and situation of the person. But it really wasn't what came out of my own life so much that made me want to deal with this subject. What I began to realize the minute I got into it was that what we were talking about here was not not babies, not women, not medicine. We're talking about the character of freedom. We're talking about the character of having a choice, having an ability to act on your own decisions, and being faced with people who had a very restrictive sense of what freedom means, who were willing to define in what circumstances freedom was allowed, who was allowed to possess it, and what the possible outcomes were. Well, that to me is not freedom. It's strange as it sounds to say, I think I felt the crisis that these protests represent less as a man or as a husband or a lover or any of the possible roles I might fill in a relationship. I felt it less as that than I did as an artist, as someone who could see that my working life depends very much upon a kind of untrammeled freedom. And what I saw going on there was one aspect of a very wide-sweeping effort in this country, I think, to eliminate choice, to reduce freedom, to threaten essentially the foundations of a secular state, where choice and diversity and freedom are extraordinarily strong values, and to turn them really into kind of just phrases. So it was very odd. I mean, I thought that I would feel it all very personally, very intimately, that I would bring back memories, but it didn't do that. It didn't have that effect. The effect it had was to, in a sense, energize me to think about these admittedly more abstract issues, but to me, profoundly important issues, because they support and guarantee and generally justify my working life and the working life of all artists and of everyone who hopes to have a kind of free and constructive life.
Verlin Klinkenberg, his article Violent Certainties is published in this month's Harper's Magazine. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Joan Tui Westman, and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.